Welcome to the Last Round MMA.
The guy's never beaten me. In order to be the champion, you have to beat the champion.
A podcast for the MMA fan.
Imagine that. Look at everybody up here. They're all dressed like me. They're all trying to talk like me. They're all trying to be me.
Bringing you in-depth interviews and more from across the MMA world.
This is like pride. You know, everybody's here. I feel great. And, you know, I can't wait. Saturday night, I'm going to crush this guy hype.
Are you ready? Let's start the show.
Welcome to the Last Round MMA. And today we have a pioneer of mixed martial arts in Canada, Justin Brookman. Thanks for joining me, Justin.
Ah, my pleasure. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, no better place to start than at the beginning. So just tell us, how did you get started in MMA?
I think I'm a bit of a stereotype where I was like, you know, angry teen looking somewhere to put my energy. And I really just stumbled into judo dojo. I told the story a million times, but we'll share it. It was March 2nd, 97. And I missed my ride to work because I was hungover and I got in a fight the night before, and wandering around in the rain, sulking. I walked into a place. Actually, it was, oddly enough, it was called God's Gym. They had a judo club inside of it. And I walked in, I talked to the owner. I'm like, man, I feel like I'm dying. I'm, you know, out of high school, no direction, drinking all the time. I said, just, I need to get in shape. I'm like, I'll sweep your floors. I'll clean the gym. I just need a place to be. And he's like, try some judo. And I got on the mats that day. And then again that night, I quit my job the next day. And I've really done nothing ever but be a professional martial artist ever since that day.
So before you started in, you know, judo, were you athletic as a child? You know, did you play many sports?
I've still never played a sport in my life. Like, I didn't grow up in a sport family or a community. Where we live, is hockey, right? And growing up, we didn't have the means for hockey. It's an expensive sport. So I never really played any sports, and I was never really pretty easy to get along with, but I was never really into the team thing. Mm. So I just, and as far as like, I was being athletic, I was a late bloomer. I didn't even realize I was a good athlete until like I kind of retired, to be honest, because I was like, as far as I was concerned, I was training harder than anyone else. And that's why I was winning. I didn't know I was good at it because I was like good at it. Mm. You know what I mean? I was like, I really didn't understand what a great athlete I was until just quite recently, where I'm like, I'm almost 50 and I can still, you know, hang with a lot of the younger guys, you know? So, as far as other sports, that just never really appealed to me. So I just, like I said, I just stumbled into the martial arts and it just kind of took over my life.
So day one, when you walked in the gym, what age were you?
I was 22 years old. Yeah.
And what job were you doing? And, you know, how did you quit? Was there any good story? You walked in, just flipped the bird at the manager and walked out?
Honestly, that's almost exactly how it worked out. Like, I was working in a factory. I was building signs, and I walked in, and I'm actually very grateful for that boss that I had back then, because he is a good dude. But like, where I was working in the building, I walked in, I was like, fuck you guys, pretty much, and walked out the door. And I was living in an apartment, and at that particular time we had a bad storm, and like there was like 3 inches of water in my apartment in the basement. And so I really, really just packed everything I could into one bag, and I moved into, within a couple of days of starting to train, I was living on the mats. Like, my blankets were smelly, like geese, you know what I mean, for like a long time. Was a mat with a crash mat for a mattress and geese for blankets, and you know what I mean, just a hoodie for a pillow, really. That was the life for quite some time.
So you were living and working at the gym, like clearing up, showing new clients around, stuff like that.
Yeah, I was really, really fortunate with my original sensei, Dan. He just instantly took me in and was like, this is what you're gonna do. And he gave me so many great opportunities, and like just to train. And, you know, training led to travel, and he always made sure there was food in my stomach and took good care of me, for sure. I was really, really fortunate.
So when you found you had that passion and you decided to quit, what was the initial aim? Because at that time, turning around and saying to someone, you know what, I'm going to be a mixed martial artist, wasn't really a thing. Whereas now, if someone said that to you, you'd be like, okay, there is a path.
Yeah. I don't know how to explain that. I'm very fortunate where I had a really great mentor at that point, like a bit of a father figure. He picked me up and he drove me to work. He's like, fucking quit, man. He's like, you're not doing what you're miserable. You know what I mean? You're abusing yourself. And he's like, what you're doing now isn't working. So what difference does it make what you do next? He's like, go for it. And he was the guy, my friend Keith, he's the guy that really steered me in the direction. And I'm like, I just knew that when I put that gi on the first time, like that was what I needed to do. And I always loved MMA and I wanted to fight. That was kind of why I guess maybe strolled into that place in the first place, because judo guys are tough dudes. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I don't want to sound like, you know, it's not like cheesy or anything, but man, I knew it. I just knew it. And there wasn't any path. I just knew I'm like, well, there's a tournament next weekend. And if I try out, go and I get a hotel to sleep in, you know what I mean? And like, if we're just kind of, it was baby steps, like compete here, compete there. There was no real direction at first and where we wanted to go, because there was no, you know, the UFC was a dream. That wasn't a thing, you know what I mean? And even competing anywhere, it just wasn't even an actual, like, it just wasn't realistic. And so, but once the ball started rolling, things just kind of fell into place. But so as far as having like a plan or a vision, or I'm like, man, I was just trying to fucking eat, you know?
Can you remember the first time you saw the UFC?
Oh, without a doubt. I'm like everyone else from my generation. I saw Hoist Gracie, and we got it on a VHS from our local video store, and probably turned it in, like gave it back like 3 weeks late. And we watched it. I wore that tape out over and over and over. I didn't understand when we watched it for the first time, like how important Hoist was, like, and why, you know, I was like more like, let's throw bombs. You know what I mean? I didn't figure out the jiu-jitsu and the Hoist Gracie thing until many years after, because I was like 93, right? And I didn't start training until 97. So, but I knew when I saw that for the first time, I'm like, man, that would be cool. So I can remember where I was, like everything the first time I saw it.
So how long between, you know, walking through the door the first day to your first ever fight?
I honestly think it may have been less than 2 years. I think I fought in 99, my first pro fight. I think it was 99. I can't remember, man. That's a long time ago. But you know, I was 2 days, 7 days a week and learning everything I could judo-wise. And then we basically were punching the bag, and we didn't really have a boxing coach. But then I met, you know, some proper jiu-jitsu guys. And my professor now, he was also like world champion. So when I moved on from judo to jiu-jitsu, my professor is actually like a badass, like legit bare knuckle karate champion. So we learned so much from him, striking and stuff like that. So I don't even think I owned a pair of gloves by the time I had my first fight. We just went for it.
So from the first day of walking in to the first fight, which I have down as June the 2nd, 2000.
Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah.
What sort of benefits did you see in yourself? You know, because everyone always says, you know, you need to do a martial art and you learn like confidence, you know, kind of like helps with your mental health and, you know, also helps you physically.
Yeah. Looking back, I didn't realize all the benefits and all the things that were happening at that time. Because you're living it, you don't really understand. I just knew that I finally found a place in the world that I felt like safe or at home, even though, you know, you're in there competing and training, sweating, but like, it didn't take me long to figure out that it wasn't about fighting. I just finally found a circle and people who genuinely like cared about me and wanted to see me be, you know, successful or productive or saw the potential in me. So, you know, and then, so I think that was the thing that really, the violence of it, of course, was like appealing to a young man, but like, it was like, man, it's community and I felt safe. It really did feel safe there. And I've never really felt that in my life before. Looking back at that phase, I realized how much I was actually transforming, you know, as far as like the confidence not to go out and get in fights and the confidence not to, to drink. And then the, you know, being surrounded by people that you can trust and being accountable for your own actions and just being all around healthier with, you know, food and diet and alcohol and things like that. Like it's, I didn't realize it at the time, but like those first couple of years are probably what really, really formed me or began to form me like as a man, you know.
So June 2nd, 2000, UCC 1, the new beginning. Your first fight was against, you may have to help me with the last name, David, is it Luiza?
Luiza, yes.
Luiza. So you won that first fight by armbar submission, yeah, in round one. Was it your decision to fight? Did the coach approach you and say, there's a show coming up?
I think that was the first sanctioned MMA event ever in Canada. And we just happened to kind of meet a couple people along the way. We were fighting, you know, underground or whatever. And the promoter, we had some ties with the promoter and we got the invite and we just kind of went for it. At that, then it was like, we didn't really, back then it was a different cult, a different sport. We weren't nearly advanced. We didn't know by today's standards, we were no fucking where near ready to fight. You know what I mean? I watched that guy fight 20 something years ago and he would get killed now, just for technique, preparation, gas tank, everything, right? But we thought, we're like, we were called, but everyone was on the same page. And I remember it was like $250, hell yeah, like, you know, I'll do it. So, and that just kind of, and yeah, just that was it. We're like, let's do it, right?
Was the $250, was that a ticket deal or was that just straight cash? You didn't have to sell tickets.
No, because we were in Montreal, so like I think we may have got tickets or something like that, but it was squat, you know what I mean? So by the time you got your license and your medicals, I was probably out $250, you know what I mean? So but we did, for us, like, we from, because we're from the Toronto area, to go to Montreal, like, we were selling tickets anyway, right? So that's 6 hours away. They were just bringing us in to die. They, like, right, their own fighters sold tickets. So
you were essentially the B-side.
Oh, my whole life. Yeah. Yeah.
So going into that first fight, what did your family and friends say? The UFC had been around for like 7 years at that point, but it probably wasn't as popular then. You know, it was kind of like still probably an underground sport, a little bit barbaric when people looked at it.
Yeah. I don't have a couple of, that's when I kind of, that age in my life too, is where I kind of start to separate from my older kind of high school buddies and stuff like that. So, and they're all like, you're crazy or whatever, but they still supported it in a way. And coming from a small town, it made me a bit of a hero as well. So that was nice. A lot of people supportive. As far as my family, like, I don't have a real strong connection with my family. Like, I know they're proud of me now, but at that stage of my life, I don't think they really even understood or maybe even knew what I was doing. There was I do remember in, there was a point in my life when my father was still alive and he's like, I told him what I was going to do. And he's like, you're a fucking idiot. And I was like, all right, we'll see. You know what I mean? I'm like, it probably wasn't the best motivation, but it's still to this day stuff that spurs me on. It's because my dad told me that I couldn't do it. Right. I'm like, yeah, all right, we'll show you. Right. I'm like, not the best way to live your life, but it's made me semi-successful, you know? So
you're following your heart, following your passion.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not all, but you know what? Now that I have my own son and whatever else, I'm like, of course I want you to. But at the same time, you know, I mean, you know, you got to be realistic and you're protective and all the other things that come along with being a parent, right? You're like, man, I personally don't want my son to fight. You know what I mean? It's a dangerous game and it's a hard life. So I can understand, especially back then when there was no education on it. It was just, yeah, barbarians. Of course they didn't. I don't think they would have wanted me to do that.
Can you remember what you felt like, you know, as you were getting your hands wrapped before walking out for your first fight?
Hands wrapped. That's hilarious. I didn't wrap my, there was no hand wraps. There was no nothing. Like I fought 10 pro fights, didn't wrap my hands once. It just didn't even really, honestly didn't even exist. Like you got to, sorry, how old are you?
How old? 37 on Saturday.
Okay. So you're a few years behind me. Like, and back then there, it was a wild, wild west. We went to shows where you brought your own gloves. Mm. You know what I mean? They didn't even have to match. Like it's, but this back then, no one was really, we weren't some of the, if you came from a boxing or a kickboxing ground or something like that, maybe you had someone who knew how to wrap hands and maybe they wrapped them, but like, but that never happened for us. But I do remember, like, and it was the same every fight I ever had, where I'm just in that. And most, a lot of guys will tell you the same thing. They're like, you're waiting in the change room and you're like, You know, like, where's the door? Like, get me the fuck out of here. What was I thinking? You almost want someone to pull the fire alarm in a way, right? Because it's scary as hell. And then, the next thing you know, you're like getting marched down the aisle, and it's like you see on TV, and you're like, holy shit, this is going to happen. And I remember looking across at Dave, and I'm like, wow, that guy's big. And then the bell rang, and it happened so fast. I was like, holy shit, like, I can't believe this is really happening. And then it just kind of went from there. And he was shit kicking me too. And they just, I was fortunately just reversed a position and ended up on top and just got the submission. So
looking back, you know, over that fight, you know, what would you have told yourself before that? And looking back now, would you have said to yourself, you know what, you would need to step back, train a little bit more?
Not really. Like I mentioned earlier, by today's standards, of course, back then, man, I think it all played out the way it was supposed to. So why change it? Like, that fight and many others from that actual card, like, that changed the course of history for us up here, right? So it was, whether I win or lose or this, that, like, we were supposed to make all those mistakes and go in unprepared and not wrap our hands and do all these things so that people today do. You know what I mean? As far as like I made all those mistakes as an athlete so that I don't have to make them all as a coach or a mentor or anything else.
So was the promotion kind of pissed at you, the fact that you came in as the B-side and you beat the hometown guy?
I would definitely say they weren't happy. And this is the way that it's unfolded as well, is it was a 8-man tournament, right? And that was round one was the first show. And I beat the heavy favorite to win the tournament. Mm. So what happened was 3 months later, they're going to run round two, and they put me in against Loazo again, right? Because they're like, oh, so-and-so's hurt or this or that. But they rearranged the bracket so he could come back in and fight me and get them, because they really did want him to win. He was a local celebrity. And he went on to fight for like a UFC title. He's a legit badass. You know what I mean? And that was, so they set me up, right? They thought it was a fluke, and it turns out they were right, because I lost in the second round, the second fight. I wasn't as prepared, and I just, you know, didn't, it was like, I beat him the first time, but really, like, that's not how it works, you know? And he got me, and he went on to win that tournament, the whole thing. And then from there, champion, UFC, and everything else, right? So that was their plan, and it worked for them. But yeah, you're always the B team. You're always the away team. Like, when, if you were from Ontario, there just wasn't anywhere to fight, right? And promoters don't want outsiders to win. It's bad for business. They need their locals to be the champions, to be the ticket sellers, right? So I understand it. Back then, I took it personally, but now I'm like, man, it's not show friends, man. It's show business, and you got to get paid. So
yeah. So how did you handle a defeat? Did you beat yourself up?
Oh yeah, it was horrible. Again, maybe grow over time, but back then, every loss is a tragedy, man. Your whole life was for that moment. I didn't take it well, I probably partied that whole, like, for 3 months afterwards until I pulled it back together, you know what I mean? But it's you hear it a lot. You get more from out of your losses than you do your wins, right? So I think it made me a better person. I knew, looking back now, especially, and I like, a lot of times fighters take losses, and it wasn't what happened in the ring or the cage. It's something you didn't do 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, training, diet, this, that. Maybe you skip a practice. Maybe you went and partied one night or whatever. Like, that's what I really learned from that fight. I'm like, man, I lost that fight because I didn't put the work in I was supposed to, like, long before the matchup ever happened. And that was something that I figured out, and I'm like, and wasn't going to let happen again.
Without fast forwarding too much, is that something that you took into your time as a coach?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. All these experiences have made me such a better coach. Like, being a fighter definitely helps you coaching. Not every fighter can coach, whatever else, but because they just don't understand teaching. But there's experiences that we have when you've actually had combat that you can really bring forward and teach your kids about. Like, I've had people I've trained. I'm like, I could tell you the day you lost that fight. You know what I mean? Because I watched you at practice, or I know, or you came in, you smelled like weed, or you know, I can tell you were out drinking last night or whatever, right? So like, I know them well, and I said, because I fucked it all up myself, you know what I mean? So I think there's definitely a lot of to being in there, being done it, carrying it forward, you know, as a coach later in your career.
And everyone handles, you know, defeats differently, right? So like, as a coach, I think, you know, you've probably just got to try to make sure it doesn't affect them too much, you know, they don't beat themselves up too much, but also keeping that, you know, that winning mentality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something I've tried to put on my athletes all the time is like, these wins and losses don't define you as a person, right? They need to be, you're your own man outside of this game, and you losing doesn't make you any less of a friend or a parent or a sibling or whatever else, or any less successful at your job or whatever else. It's just a win and a loss, and it hurts a lot, man. It's heartbreak, but man, it doesn't, you can't let it get to the point where it's going to wreck your life. Like, that because I lost doesn't make me a horrible person, or I'm not fucking, you know, I'm a loser. I competed in a sport and I lost that night, and that's it, right? I wish it was that easy, but that really, it is what, that's what it is.
So fast forward, in June 15th, 2002, UCC 10, Battle of the Belts.
Yeah.
A fight I don't think you've ever touched on in any podcast I've ever watched of yours, Justin. You fought against George St. Pierre, lost via armbar in round one. So, you know, anybody that's listening to this, I'm sure, is obviously an MMA fan and they know who George St. Pierre is. Going into this fight, had you heard about George?
Yeah. He was the option that we were given for a title. I was champion at the time, and he was the option we were given. We weren't given any other options. I actually didn't want to fight him because he was only 1-0, right? And I also knew he was a fucking stud, but I'm like, the numbers don't match up. But again, he's the local celebrity. They want to put him in the spot, and so he got the shot at it. And yeah, that's what, the rest was history. He just smashed me and took it and went home. So it's that one hurt because I worked so hard to become a champion. That was how, you know, it was all I ever had, and that's how I fed myself and where else. And like, so that one was really crushing. But over time, I realized how important it was to take that loss. But yeah, we knew who George was. We didn't have a lot of tape or anything like that on him. We knew he was great at striking. We knew he was a really good athlete. We'd heard rumors of, like, you know, him competing, but you never saw anything. And they were all true, because when that dude grabbed a hold of me, I was fucked, right? So he's a monster.
Just to explain kind of like the finish, because on another podcast I was listening to when I was doing the research, you kind of talked about, you know, how he was in mount, and then you kind of came up with like an idea of kind of like giving your arm.
Well, yeah. What happened was, we ended up in that position, and he was like, he was beating on me. Like, it was going to get stopped either way. He was just bouncing my head off the floor. And so I'm like, I knew I'd already got out of the mount once, but when I got stuck in there again, I'm like, I was pretty sure I wasn't getting out without taking way more punches than I already had. So I kind of just offered up the, I don't want to say offered up, but I'm like, kind of like, here, go for this. And maybe that's my window to get out, because I knew I was already doomed. And I was, like I said, he hit me enough times that I was already pretty slow, and there was no getting out at that point. So really, like, big picture, I'm like, nah, he submitted me instead of like putting me in the hospital. So that's a win, I guess, right? So because I think the first 10 guys he fought, they all went to the hospital. Like, he's a savage.
Could you tell afterwards, you're like, okay, this guy's gonna go far?
I said it to my buddy when I got out of the ring, like, that day, I'm like, that guy's gonna be star. Like, yeah, you could tell. It just genetically, you're looking at him, like, he's such a big, strong guy, and he's the people love him, and he's polite, and he's handsome. Like, he's got, you know, he's got the whole package, and he's got that, he's a fierce, fierce competitor. And I'd never had anyone grab me where I was like, holy shit. Like, cause I'm a pretty strong guy. Like, a lot of my attributes that, like, made me, one of the attributes made me successful and was like, I'm very strong and very fast. And that guy grabbed me, and I was like, holy shit, I feel like a child. Like, yeah, it was a complete mauling. Like, I don't deny it.
And How did you cope with that loss? And how would you, you know, advise people that are listening to this? You know, is there certain things like get straight back in the gym, you know, avoid going to a bar and trying to drown your sorrows, I guess?
Yeah, that was the most important fight of my career. Without a doubt, it was, because I realized after that I needed to be much more disciplined. Now, I sat around for probably a month and made excuses. You know what I mean? I lost because of this, I lost because of that. And then when I finally swallowed it and be like, I lost because that guy's way fucking better than me, then I was able to move on. And I was like, I need to be more disciplined in my diet because I think I can make 155. I mean, be more structured and more disciplined in my training, like just with everything. I'm like, if you're going to, there's levels to this, right? And that's when we were really starting to see them. It wasn't just tough guys anymore. I'm like, so that gave me a lot more discipline and a lot more drive to make sure I'm doing things properly. Like, which we were making up as we went, but like, I'm like, he taught me that we need to be better in every area of what we do. And that one particular fight and that one loss made me go down to 155, which landed me in the next phase of my career, which turned out to be more important than anything I'd done before. So.
And how easy was that to make 155 for you?
The first time I did it was pretty hard because I hadn't done it before, and we didn't. Now I can do it easily because I understand how to cut weight. Back then, we're just like not eating for a week and not drinking water, like literally everything wrong you could possibly do. That's what we were doing, right? So it was hard. My last couple fights were, I kind of had it down. My very last fight I fought in Tokyo, that was a hard weight cut because of the flight, and they being the B team that had nowhere to cut weight, or that wasn't allowed the saunas, and all, that's a whole different, but I still made the weight. But 155 for me, once I figured out how to do it, wasn't that bad.
You just pretty much led us on to where we were going to go. So your last pro fight, November the 12th, 2004, big, big fight. Obviously you fought in Shooto over in Tokyo, Japan, against Yoichi, is it Fukumoto? Is that pronounced properly?
Fukumoto, yes.
Okay, so how did that fight come about? And just kind of explain to everybody like how big an event and how big that is for anybody to fight there in martial arts.
Yeah, it's to me, that's one of the greatest things I ever accomplished in my career. The way it worked, that because the UFC has this amazing ability to erase like history, you know what I mean? And they have such a monopoly out that you know this. People think the UFC is MMA. They, you know, you hear it all the time. I train UFC, you know what I mean? But in the early 2000s, there wasn't quite the 155 than the UFC yet. So everyone from 155 down, the greatest fighters on the planet, they were all in Shooto, whether it was Shooto Japan or Shooto Brazil, like all the best guys, lightweight fighters in the world were all there. So when I got that invite, that was our UFC. That's where we wanted to be, like in Japan at the Mecca, like that's where we wanted. And so we got that opportunity to go, we got the phone call, and like, absolutely. And it was, yeah, that was, it's, sometimes I get a little pissy because I'm like, I wish people really understood like what a big fucking deal that is, or it was at that time. You know what I mean? It was, it's the equivalent of your invite to the UFC now, you know what I mean? So, we got the call to make that, to do that fight. And it was, yeah, one of the greatest nights of my life.
Just walk us through that. So you received the call. I'm sure that you probably just jumped at the chance straight away.
Yeah. Yeah. We got that phone call. I thought, the beauty of Shooto was they had, shows all over the world, and that was their feeder. Right. So I fought Shooto, in Vancouver, and I had a wicked performance. I knocked my guy out very quickly, and I got the phone call like 3 weeks after that. And that's kind of how it unfolded. And then we hopped the plane, flew to Tokyo, and then just went for it. And you fight at the Kyokushin Hall, which is at the Tokyo Dome, and it's like legendary. When you're walking down the hallway, every fighter, Hoist and Hickson and all the Shamrocks and Boss, and everyone's signatures on the walls because they all fought in that place, right? So that was like the place, not only the organization I wanted to fight, but that's like the building I wanted to fight in too. Cause every legendary fight I've ever seen happened there. And we got there a little head. We flew in 2 days before the fight, and we came a bit heavy, but we made the weight. It was a pain in the ass, but I skipped with a skipping rope, got in a sauna suit, skipped off 13 pounds. And then I didn't really realize going into it because we're all kind of naive, but I think I was co-main event. And I realized it when we got there, like they parade all the fighters out, red, white corner, black corner. And then and we introduce us and then they handed my opponent the mic. And he gave the crowd a big speech and they all went nuts. And I was like, oh shit, we're brought here to die again. Right. But the way that fight unfolded, it was just the best performance I ever had. That was like the first time ever. I felt like I can do everything. I can punch, I can kick. I've always been able to throw guys, my jiu-jitsu, everything just flowed nice and connected. Even now, I look back at it. I'm like, man, you look like a real mixed martial artist, like good everywhere, right? And it was the best performance I ever had. It was one of the best trips of my life. It was amazing. And then right back on an airplane and home in 4 days. It's wicked.
And this was something that you really wanted to do for your coach as well.
Yeah. So my Shaw Franco he's my jiu-jitsu professor. That's how I met him. But he was also, he's world karate champion. And like when karate was still fucking amazing and before it was watered down, he'd never been and he always wanted to be. And I remember when I met him, I'm going to take you there one day. We're going to go there one day. And it was like we blinked. And then all of a sudden I'm like, holy shit, we're actually going to Tokyo. So to me, that like what made that trip was us going together and the fact that like we kind of, it manifested, you know what I mean? Like, we're going to fucking do this. And it all happened. It was great. So it was big because, you know, when you're that steep in karate and the culture and everything else, you never got to go to the homeland. You know what I mean? It was important to him. So, it was cool that we got to do it together.
Did you get to see much of Tokyo whilst you were there, or it was just kind of fly in 4 days, fly out?
That I've been a few times, but that time was like so fast. We were in and out. Like we went, wandered around the city and then, which is just the craziest place in the world. And then made the wait, did the flight. I think we had 1 day to wander around or a half day to wander around. Then we were right back out of there. So, but I'm really lucky where I got to go back. I've been back a couple times now and really got to explore and have fun. So
how was the culture of MMA there? Obviously the fans are very different.
Yeah. I love Japanese MMA still to this day. It's changed a little bit, but like they much more appreciation for the actual martial arts side of it. Whereas UFC is American football and everything, you know what I mean? Like there, it's still, they're not booing you if you hit the ground, if you pull off a nice technique, people clap for you and the crowds are very relaxed and subdued and they're not just, there's no just bleed guys out there. You know what I mean? Everyone's just kind of, I think there's much more appreciation for the actual martial arts side of it. So I really like that competing in front of that.
Did you know going into that fight that you were going to retire? And if you did,
no.
That performance, did you think, I should stay?
No, what had happened was I had some pretty nasty neck injuries that I was dealing with. And I actually hurt my neck in judo, like, right when I started, and it got worse and worse. So I did that fight. I had a herniated C6, C7, and that was like just bursting. And also what happened too is I actually fractured my T7. And then I made it through that fight. And it was like 3 weeks later, I was just rolling in a gi with a friend of mine and he gave me a little bump on top of the head and I was like, ugh, it hurt and my fingers went numb and everything else. And then it was like that night I was like paralyzed, like just lying in bed and I couldn't get up. And I battled with that that would have been before Christmas that year. And I battled with it for a couple of years, all sorts of different therapies and chiro and this and that and decompression, there was no way around it until I had to go get some fusions and stuff like that. So I didn't know I was going to retire. Because I was still getting, it was a year later, I was still getting offers, and the fights you were offering me were incredible. Like, because that fight put me in at number 9 in the world. So all the fights that we were offering me was like Kawajiri and Joachim Hansen and Aoki and like all these guys. I'm like, fuck yeah, I'll fight them. But I'm like, can't get off the couch right now. So it's guys that, they went on to be world champions. They were like, really high up. And that's who I was finally lumped in with, but it was just time to let it go and move on.
You said something very interesting, and it makes you think on another podcast. You said a fighter dies twice when they retire.
It's an awful way to put it, but it's true. Like, what if you're really a fighter and you've really dedicated your life to it, or any sport. It doesn't matter what you play. If that's all you've ever been your entire life and you've retired, like that part of you kind of died. It's kind of, you can't, and I have a really hard time not looking back and at it and tripping over what's in front of me, right? So like you kind of that part of your life ends and you still got another how many years to figure it out and try to find a way to be happy and fill the void that fighting gave you, right? So I think it's very true that phrase, and it's what I try to help my younger guys figure out. I'm like, dude, this you could go undefeated, be champion of the world, it still ends. So you got to kind of have a plan and figure out, and like that, don't let it define you as a person, because you're more than that. Like otherwise you will spend the rest of your life talking about the good old days, you know what I mean? Or you're Al Bundy talking about high school football, you know what I mean? Like, you don't want, like, there's no way to live your life. We have to find things to satisfy your soul and make you happy after fighting, or it's a really, really difficult life. It has been, I've had the greatest life, man. I have a beautiful family and I've been very successful, but like, man, there's still a big piece that's missing because I can't do it anymore. And it's really painful sometimes.
Was there ever a time where you considered coming back, even due to the injuries?
I tried, like, yeah, every fucking day, every day, still. You know what I mean? I'm like, I just wish, but I know that I've had great opportunities and offers. And then basically, like, if your body, I'll fight anyone. It's only 15 minutes long, but that training camp, like, there's no way my body could make it through those things. And at that time, dude, the pain was so unbelievable that there's no way I could have done it, right? But yeah, super hard pill to swallow. But it's the way of the world. Like, no matter how good you are, right? But yeah, I dream about fighting all day, every day. It's the best fucking thing in the world. And it's hard to, it's really, I'm almost 50 and it's really hard to let go of.
And how was it when there was that point when the realization kicked in, like, this is done, did you?
It was tough. What made it, I also opened my own gym in 2004. So there was that overlap in that transition into running, coaching and running my business. And I think that, and keeping me involved in the life. And I think that was a real big saving grace for me. You know what I mean? Had I just had to go back to work into a factory, excuse me, or something like that, I don't think it would have ended well. Fortunately, like, things lined up and fell into place where I was starting to build my own students and build a business and get to that next phase of my life, right? Where I'm very lucky because not a lot of people that fight can coach, right? So, but it all just kind of worked out. So, it was a serious struggle, but having the people around me, teammates and supporters, like, they made it a lot easier for sure.
You said in another podcast, you think that you're more of a protector than a fighter. So do you think you were maybe more of a coach than a fighter, and that was your kind of real role?
Yeah, man, you did your research, dude. Way to go. I don't know. I flip flop on that. Because there are some days where I look at my, I'm like, I hear myself talk when I'm in a room full of fighters, and I'm like, no, I'm a fucking killing machine. I know I am. I'm a savage. But then there's other days that I'm in a room full of kids or a room full of like fighters that I'm looking to protect or people that I'm looking to protect, and I'm like, and that, so sometimes you feel like, you're a protector. But I think the world needs the world needs strong men who aren't afraid to kind of show their feelings and be vulnerable and go out of their way to protect people and whatever else. And I think it's a combination of, yeah, I am a fucking savage, but I care about people. And I think that's what makes it all kind of work out, you know? So it's so like a little bit of both. Being a fighter makes you a good protector, and being a protector makes you a good fighter.
And do you think the fact that you touched on earlier that you had to work so hard day in, day out to get to where you were, and you weren't necessarily genetically gifted, do you think that's why also that you were such a good coach, because you had to take it a step at the time? You know, some people who are genetically gifted, they just pick it up and they don't necessarily understand the game or the sport. They're just good at it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it really helps because, you know, martial arts, one of the greatest benefits is the work ethic that it instills in you. And I had to work hard and scrape for every inch that I got. And so I think that's a trait that I'm able to put on my own students and not to take it for granted what they have, whether it's athleticism or opportunity or whatever else, right? Like, if the harder you work and the slower you gather that information or technique or whatever else, or money or whatever, then the harder it is for someone to take it away from you. So I think that's a really valuable thing that I gained over the years from working like that. It's like, if you work hard and you build solid foundations, you're going to have it for a lot longer. So.
And do you think more people nowadays need to train or do some type of sport? Because it seems like a lot of people now who grow up in this day and age, they don't know how to lose, you know, because everything's kind of given to them. And, you know, a lot of sports now, even if you just compete, they give you a trophy, you know, whereas in you know, like martial arts, there is a winner and there is a loser. A loser, and you also learn discipline.
Yeah, I think the beauty of martial arts for any age group is it is an individual effort, but it is a team. It's still a team atmosphere, right? So, like, it's a team effort. But on game day, it's just you. You know what I mean? So you learn to be out there and under the microscope and deal with the pressure and compete and get, you know, accomplish your goal, win, whatever else. But you learn that you can't be successful in that individual sport, whatever else, unless you have a solid team of people around you, right? Like any sport, your team is your first job. You have a coach who's your boss. You have teammates who are your coworkers, and you don't have to like everyone, but you have to learn how to get along with people and take instructions from your coach, your boss, so that the entire team can be successful. Right. And I think that's a big thing that martial arts can teach everyone, because it's harsh, but like I've used this a few times, but not every pony gets to be a Pegasus. You're gonna fucking lose. Everyone does. You're not gonna win every fight. There's always someone better. People have such a hard time with that. Like, why'd my kid lose? Because the other kid's better than yours, right? Or why did I lose? I'm like, he was better than me, right? There's always that excuse that we like to come up with, but it's not necessarily true. That's why there's only one world champion, just one in the whole world. So more than likely, it's not gonna be, you know, me. That's just how it is. But it teaches us to take losses and grow from them. I said, well, you can either cower and lay on the couch and make excuses, or you're like, okay, well, we need to do our best to make sure that doesn't happen again. And it will also teach you that it's probably going to happen again, but it's okay. Right. But there's nothing worse in this world than participation ribbons. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Or trophies for fourth. Like that, it should be like that. Cause we're just fooling our kids and our athletes into thinking, you know, that you're always going to get your way. You're always going to win. It doesn't work like that. Sometimes you're not going to get the job. You know what I mean? Sometimes you're not going to get the girl. Like, it's just life, right? I really think it helps with that.
So 2004, you opened your gym. 2005, there was a huge fight. Stephen Bonner, Forrest Griffin, April 2005. Just kind of describe the effect that had on MMA and also your gym.
Yeah, it was, I remember we were all watching the show for the months before. And then I think it was a Thursday night or something, but that fight went down. And man, when I showed up to work on Monday, man, they were lined up. It was crazy. You know, we were primarily known for a jiu-jitsu school, but we were the only legit jiu-jitsu and really the only MMA around for for miles in every direction, cities in every direction. So that was like, that was everyone that was like, holy shit. And they just kind of, that's what really changed. It changed the martial arts landscape because that's what catapulted the UFC. But really for me, that's really getting, what really got me going as a business was actually that fight. Yeah.
And did you focus more on professional fighters, the children's side, a mixture of both?
Yeah, it was like the first few, I'm like, I want to train fighters and this and that, like for the first little bit. Then you realize fighters cost money. They're a pain in the ass. And you're right. You got to put your effort into the kids and think about, and to pay the bills. And you also build a future. Like you have someone come in the door as an adult, you'll get them for a couple of years. If you have a kid and you teach them properly and you treat them well and you help them grow, you'll have them, you know, you'll have them for 10 years. And then one day they'll bring their kids to you as well, right? So you got to like kind of look at the big picture, right? So everyone, of course, we all want them. I'd love to work with athletes all day, every day, but like there's just not that many, right? So yeah, if you want to be successful in martial arts, put your effort into the children for sure. It makes them better people, and it will definitely be better on your bank account.
And also when you're working with like the mixture, you still get to know, you get to work people's corners. So you're still getting that taste of the professional side.
Yeah. I'm really fortunate right now, the position I'm in where I do like a lot of high level coaching and still kind of, I still get to travel. I'm off to Italy tomorrow for the World Junior Championships for kickboxing. I've got a lot of fights lined up over the fall and the winter. So like I'm pretty fortunate where I get to travel a lot and corner and stay in that mix, you know, especially with fighters I really like and the level of athletes that make it super fun.
And you visited over 30 plus countries, I hear.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been, I believe it's 35, around 35 countries that I've been to. A lot of them directly related to martial arts, and a lot of them just because of the lifestyle that martial arts has given me. I never went anywhere in my life until really Japan. And then after that, I just snapped. I'm like, let's go, let's fly, let's go somewhere. You know, I like to see new places. And if we can go there and pick a fight at the same time, then that makes it even more fun.
Your favorite countries that you've been to for MMA?
You can't compete with Japan. It's amazing. It's I'm not sure what the landscape would be. I haven't been there in like 5 or 6 years. But I love MMA in Japan. I'm really lucky where I got to corner UFC in Brazil and I also got to be on the mats with like a lot of really great fighters down there. They're a little more bloodthirsty, really proud people, and really like they're loud, man, because they're football fans too. They're like that culture, right? They really get into it. It was cool to fight there. I got to fight in Thailand, and that was a really unique experience as well. I really enjoyed that. I don't know, man, like that, the beauty of fighting is it's universal. Everyone understands it. So you can take it anywhere and do it. If someone will come watch, it's fun. Right now the crowds are different everywhere, but yeah. But to answer your question, Japan's the greatest place in the world.
Worst place you've been.
Fucking England. I hated England. Couldn't stand it, man. I was in London. I was like, this place sucks. Why would anyone want to come here? But I was at the end of a long trip and I was like, just get me home, right? But like, there's been a few countries where I'm like, I could not do this again. Like, no problem. So, but I also love every country because they have their own unique, like, you know, the UK loves their boxing and now they're bare knuckle, and Brazil loves their Vale Judo or their Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and Japan still loves their Judo and their Karate. So everywhere you go, you kind of get that. And the Thais love their boxing, their kickboxing. Like, so I like that part too, where like they got, everyone speaks their own language, but they got their own dialect, you know?
What fight were you in London for?
Oh, I was just breezing through. I don't even remember what it was come from. I just remember that if there's a place I don't want to go again in my life, it's just that.
So. Just kind of describe to us, you know, from the very first day that you walked into this to do judo to now, how much the sport has evolved.
It is crazy. Like it's been 25 years, but it feels like the blink of an eye how so really it has taken a quarter of a century for people to evolve into how good they are now. But like these kids, like I'm heading overseas tomorrow with one of my kids, and I've had him since he was 11 and he's 17. And this kid, he's a world-class kickboxer who can wrestle and is a badass blue belt in jiu-jitsu, you know what I mean? And he learned all that in 6 years, where that's how fast it all happened. I think that's, there's this, the athletes are starting much younger. There's much more accessibility to great training, great gyms and information. There's more, finally we're starting to be some more money. It's just, and it's still evolving all the time. Like I watched the ADCC last weekend and I was like, holy shit. Like that tournament is massive now. Like everything, the jiu-jitsu, the MMA, everything's just growing. And sometimes it feels like it's overnight. And then you just take a step back and be like, oh no, not really. It's been a process, you know what I mean? But it's just like technology, always growing, always changing, always cutting edge. And that's in every sport is the same. I guess it's just a little bit different for me or and my friends and community and whatever else, because we are so involved in it that we didn't even really notice it was happening.
Who would you say is the most talented fighter that didn't make it? So somebody that may have been in the gym that, you know, had a good job, didn't want to fight, or they kind of wilted under the lights?
Like my own guys or in general, or
just in general, someone that you've maybe like rolled with or practiced with, or even someone you coach now.
Oh, I've seen, wouldn't put names on it for sure, but I've seen guys that are like in the mat room, crush everyone and sparring, rolling that, and then just not even want to compete, or they get out there and they underperform. But to give you an example of the opposite, I have a guy, his name is Bill Poland. He's one of my black belts, and he teaches at the same gym I'm at. But very, very hardworking, disciplined guy, not a crazy athlete, was always, you know, in the upper end of training, like as far as the athletes on the mat, but not one of the freaks. But man, when that cage door locked and the lights went on, he was a fucking murderer. Like, he went 5-0 against all guys like John Dodson and Romello, like all these guys that went on to the UFC and stuff. And he beat all these guys. He was one guy that some guys are just game day guys. Mm. Some guys think they are, and then they go wilt. Right. And it takes a different species to get out there and do it. And until you go do it, you don't actually know. Right. You see it quite often. People just, all these guys highly touted, they just come out and underperform because they can't handle the pressure. Right. And then you see guys that are just, they should be workhorses or journeymen, and they come smash, you know what I mean? Because they're just born to do it.
That is so true. Very true. So you had your gym until COVID, and then.
Yeah, made it about a year into COVID. Then it was time to kind of make a switch. I had a great career, traveled, made some money and built a home. And then that was an exhausting job. So after, you know, 12, 14 months of COVID, it was, you know, we kind of made the decision that maybe it's best to like just fold and try something else. All, you know, there's a lot of gyms in the area who owned by my students who, were, you know, I knew would carry the torch and take my students in. And like I say, just physically and emotionally, it was time to kind of make a move. So COVID gave me that kind of opportunity, like kicking the ass to actually like, you know, man up and do something. And so it kind of unfolded like that. And I miss my gym every single day. It is really hard sometimes to wake up knowing you're not going in there, but I'm pretty fortunate with how I landed on my feet. So
the podcast, the Justin Bruckner Adventure, is that,
yeah.
Are we going to see the return?
Funny you say that. I don't know if I'll do that again. So my partner, Josh, we had COVID crushed our podcast really. Cause, a lot for a lot of different reasons. Josh was his own direction in his career. And it's really hard to, I love doing podcasts. Like I really do enjoy it, but I love doing it live. I love having the guests and feeling the energy. And so when that COVID kind of crushed that a little bit, cause we had our own studio in Toronto, things were going very well. And then it's, just kind of lost the flavor, and we start career wise, we started moving around and then, but literally, today I saw Josh just today for the first time in at least a year and a half. And I just had to stop by and visit him real quick because we totally lost contact. And I went by and saw him today. And like, so who knows, maybe something will pop up in the future. And I got a couple ideas that I like. I really enjoyed it. Like, I think it's why you do it. It's fun to sit and talk to new people and make new friends and gather information. Like, I loved my podcast because it wasn't an MMA podcast. I just find like whoever I thought, like, I have questions, you're going to have the answers. I'm going to invite you. And we just shot the shit, right? It was really fun. So I think I have something up my sleeve that maybe I'll get back to that. I like to talk. It's fun. It's the only other thing I'm good at other than punching people in the face. It's like performing and delivering, right? I enjoy it. So when I get back to a spot where I feel like I'm really going to love it again, and it's not, you know, really that much, it's not so much of a job, then I'll get back to it.
Everyone has a story.
Yeah, they do. They do. Yeah. It's and the best podcasts are when you just sit and hang out and you just talk, right? I mean, you get those moments of like, oh, you know, that's, yeah, everyone's got a great story.
Tattoo laser removal. That's the,
yeah,
the career right now.
Yeah. I work at Unwanted Laser Tattoo Removal. It's the second funnest job in the world. I really love going to work. It's when I was given the opportunity or pitched it, I was like, yeah, that sounds great. Let's do that. I understand tattoos. All my friends are artists, or, you know, I've been around that culture for a long time. And I see a lot of bad tattoos, and I like people, and I'm a people pleaser. So I was like, yeah, let's go for it. That why I love the job so much is you're helping people. It's much more fulfilling than I thought it would be. How much you can help people by getting rid of a bad memory or a bad piece of art, or maybe even permanent makeup that they hate, or something they got to see every day. It's like when they leave there and that sense of relief and how happy they are, it's the best feeling, man. Like I get to help someone out every single day. And I think it's a hard job, but it's great. It gives me a lot of purpose and I really enjoy it. And I had the greatest teammates that I work with, and like everything about it, where I work, the people I work with, the actual procedure, like it's all awesome. It's great.
This is, you know, obviously a podcast, so it's audio, but for people who don't know, you are pretty much tattooed head to toe.
I am. I've been collecting tattoos since I was probably 15 years old. So yeah. I'm tattooed head to toe. And I've got tattoos from all over the planet. Like I try to get tattooed every country I go to. Like, yeah, I just, what I do, I guess I collect tattoos.
There must be at least one or two good stories about your tattoos and traveling around the world and collecting.
Oh yeah.
Any funny stories you can share with us?
We could do a whole story episode just on my tattoos. Man, I just got, there's so many funny ones, but I'll give you, again, I've been tattooed everywhere. I think the one that we'll keep it martial arts related is I had one of my fighters, James Clark. We went to Singapore for the Gamma World Championships tournament just before COVID hit, and James lost a split decision in the finals of the Worlds. But we're out partying that night, and we wandered into a tattoo studio in the middle, like 3 o'clock in the morning. I didn't even know why the hell it was open. We were just shit faced. And I ended up with a tattoo on my hand of a dagger. Another kid we had with us, this kid is like, yeah, no tattoos, like probably still lived at home with his mom. I won't say geek, but he's not the guy to get a tattoo. He's like, what are you getting? He's like, and he's drunk too. And he's like, I'll get that. Like, you know what I mean? It was like, those are the funnest stories where like, a bunch of dudes just traveling the world, picking fights, getting drunk, and getting fucking sailor tattoos. You know what I mean? Like, I really have a million tattoo stories because the fun ones are the little ones that you get when you're on some sort of journey. You know, they're your scrapbook.
Any favorite pieces that you have?
That's hard. That changes on mood. I've got big elaborate pieces from my son's godfather is one of the best in the world. So he's made me some big, huge, amazing tattoos. But and then I have different artists that I've intentionally traveled to go see, and then little travel tattoos. But I think probably my favorite tattoos. I don't know if you can see that. I have a rose on the palm of my hand. It's really, really simple, but I really love it because it's a rose. You can't fuck with a rose. You know what I mean? It symbolizes so much. It just symbolizes love, man, and be kind to people. And it's probably my favorite one. And the placement of it too. You don't see people, everyone's got a tattoo now, but you don't see too many people with their palms tattooed. Right. So to me, I'm like, I love the symbolism, but I also think, it's still got that shock value to it, which kind of was like why when I was a kid, that's why we got tattooed in the first place. And another one, I have a hummingbird on my hand, and that's close to one of my favorites too. It means a lot to me. It's just hummingbirds, man. They're beautiful. Man, they're just most resilient creatures. And that, so to me, that was like a big, big thing for me for that one. It's just, man, just get up every day and power forward, right? So, yeah, those are probably my two favorites.
Most painful?
Oh, man. Palms of the hand are like, they fucking held me down. And you got to go and do it a few times because the ink falls out of your hand. So I'm like, yeah, man, it is not cool. It's awful.
Anyone you would have liked to have fought if you hadn't had to retire?
Yeah. I would have liked to have fought Aoki. And it sucks because he was on the table and he's still going now, you know, in 1FC. I just think then I would have been a horrible style. There's no way he would have taken me down. I think I would have smashed him. He's the guy that I always really would have loved to got in there and got it done with. Another guy's Kawajiri, he's retired now. Would have loved to have fought him. Like, and so yeah, as far as like actual people, like not like mythical creatures, yeah, those two guys probably. You know what I mean? Like, I think they would have been a lot of fun style wise to get it done.
Looking back on your career, could you even have imagined everything that you've achieved, from pro fighting to coaching to all the places you've traveled?
Not in a million years, man. I still like, I don't know, man. I'm the most fortunate person alive, and just coming from, I don't want to be like that guy that's like, oh, come from nothing. I'm like, man, but my life as a kid, as a youngster, and the things that happened to me, like, I shouldn't even be here. So when I wake up and my job is to teach martial arts and travel and train, I'm like, and the biggest thing for me is making differences in people's lives, get them on that path or helping them one way or another. I'm like, I never could have guessed. Like, I find myself consistently like waking up and I'm like, how the fuck I'm going to be in Italy next week. And I'm going to wake up and I'm like, how did you get here, man? How'd you get here? How'd this happen? And that seems to happen like a lot. That's a pretty good feeling when you can wake up wondering, like, in a good way, how the hell did we end up here, you know? And it's, I never in a million years would have guessed that this was even possible, because I feel like I don't deserve it certain days. And when we started, it didn't even exist. It just, we made it up. It makes it even crazier. Like, this story, yeah, it didn't even, it could, 30 years ago, 25 years ago, it wasn't even a thing that you would travel the world, fight, and do all these amazing things. It just happened, you know?
So what's next for Justin Brookman?
A lot of great things. Let's say travel for some fights. We're working on we're rebuilding our fight team with a lot of youngsters. We've got some great fights set up for this fall and for winter, and our fight camps are getting bigger and bigger, and people are coming in from other areas to stay and train with us. Like, so as a team, we're becoming much more respected and more organized. And I think you're going to see in 5 years from now, you'll see another wave of like UFC fighters coming out of our gym. And, you know, of course, the end goal one day is to train a world champion, right? Maybe that champion's not even born yet, but that's always going to be the goal, is bring someone up and get it, and, you know, and put a real belt around the waist. But more importantly than anything is like, I want to keep myself in a position where I can continue to just kind of help people get better with martial arts, life, whatever. I'm like, I just want to keep being a part of other people's success story, no matter what it is. You know, if it's on the mats or anywhere else, it doesn't matter. I just want people to be fucking awesome. And if I can help you be awesome, that's what I want to keep doing.
One question I always like to finish on is, what would you tell somebody that's kind of like you were that day, where they're, you know, they're kind of lost, they stumble on something and they find themselves a passion?
What do you got to lose, man? If you can actually, the hardest part is finding something that you are passionate about and finding that purpose. So if you're lucky enough or fortunate enough to find something that you care about that much and you want to chase, then do it. Because chances are pretty good that you're not happy where you are now. So what do you have to lose? I had nothing to lose going for it, because I had nothing. You know what I mean? It's not like, there's different ways to look at it, but like, I literally had nothing. So I went for it with nothing to lose. Now, some people are like, man, but I have a job and a wife and a house and all this stuff. Like, yeah, I know. But like, that, there's always a way, man. I'm not saying everyone's going to live out their dreams, but like, man, there's no medicine for regret. You know what I mean? You want to spend your whole life wondering if you should have started that new business, or should have, you know, jumped on the mat, or should have done this fight or whatever else. I'm like, I think it's better to just get out there and give it a shot. And maybe you come up in short on the end of it, but like, you'll sleep a lot better knowing that you tried.
No. What a better place to finish it than you saying.
There
that.
You go. There you go.
Thank you for your time, Justin. I just want to give you the platform to, you know, your social media handles, your business, the podcast, you know, wherever people can find you.
Yeah. Instagram is Cal Samrat. Cal Samrat Gym. Another gym in our area that's amazing is Muay Thai Whippy on Instagram. Big Country MMA Instagram. My business is Unwanted LTR. Maybe just get out and support your local fighters and your local business, and do your best to make the world a better place and help people around you. I got a question for you. Like, I'm looking at you. I'm sorry. I look at your roster of guests. I'm like, what the fuck you want to talk to me for? I'm interested in how you found me and know who I am and whatever else. Right. So,
I found you like through Instagram, and then just different podcasts that I'd watched. You appeared on one, and then you speak very well, and you had a very good good story. And like you touched on before, I'm the same. I watch a ton of different podcasts, and everyone has a story.
Cool. Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. It's like, when you contact me, I looked up and I looked at the people you've had in your show. I'm like, whoa. I'm like, I feel a little under pressure right now, because there's some pretty interesting names on there, and I'm just really honored to be on your guest list. So thank you very much.
No, yeah, of course, yeah. I'm the same as you. Like, I like to interview everybody from different walks of life, you know, just because they're a class A celebrity doesn't mean they don't have an interesting or, you know, better story than, you know, somebody lower down. And, you know, like doctors, cut men, you know, I try to make a variation of different people, you know, journalists, different types of media, just to try to mix it up for the listeners. And we had one of the ones that got most traction and the most messages was actually a bare knuckle fighter, Chevy Bridges, who, you know, was kind of relatively kind of like unknown, I would say, compared to some of the other people like Stitch Duran. But that was one of the ones that I got one of the most messages for, a lot of feedback on that one. Yeah,
awesome. Well, keep it up. Like, you go for it, man. Like, I'm happy for you, and I look forward to seeing where you take it. So just keep powering forward, man. And I'm really happy to meet you and be on your show.
Yeah, no worries. Do you want anything for your podcast? Do you want to announce where that is or where they can find it, hopefully?
Man, you can go back and check out past episodes of the Justin Brucken Adventure, but it's just sitting on the shelf right now. And the adventure's not over. If you watch social media, I'll pop up with some sort of new mission soon. Right now, I'm going to just keep training killers and try to make the world a better place.
And we are at TLR MMA on Instagram and Twitter. And catch us next time. This is The Last Round.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Last Round MMA Podcast. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes and interviews. In the meantime, follow The Last Round MMA on Twitter and Instagram at TLR MMA.